Okay, as Graham has just said, Deuteronomy is one of the most puzzling books around, quite simply because it's so old. We're looking at something which is at least 5,000 years old. Dad said 1500 BC. And we live in 2022 Anno Domini. How does that even fit? That they thought differently, they said things differently, they did things differently, that they didn't even know what half the things the Romans understood might be, which is as far as we can go. We're talking about virtually almost in the times of the cavemen, further forward than that, but quite close. So how on earth do we even try to make some kind of sense of this? Well, we start by asking ourselves, who wrote Deuteronomy? Let's say Moses, okay? We know it's been edited, but we know virtually 97% of what we have got in here is what Moses would have said. Okay, so yes, it was Moses who wrote it. And these are his last words. It's actually quite appropriate that we're looking at this tonight as we remember the passing of our beloved Queen Elizabeth II. Because whenever a leader dies, or whenever a leader steps down, they usually have a chance to say their last will and testimony. How do they want to be remembered? What do they want to be remembered for? How do they feel at the time they step down? That's why in Hebrew, Deuteronomy is actually called Haravim, words. That's its Hebrew term. Deuteronomy itself actually means the second law. And although that sounds very good, Haravim, words, is actually what we are looking at here. Moses' words. This is how it begins. These are the words Moses spoke to all Israel in the desert east of the Jordan. That is, in the Arab opposite Suth, between Aran and Tupel, Laban. And you've got a list of names here. It takes 11 days to go from Horeb, that's Sinai, to Kadesh Barnea, beneath the Mount, on the Mount Seir road. So, in other words, Moses is speaking at a time of great upheaval. The people have been wandering in the desert for 40 years. They're now going to go into the land. And Moses isn't coming. Everything is going to change. For the last 40 years, they've been eating manna. What is it? No, I'm not asking a question there. That is what they called it. They called it ma, what, na. What's this? God has been providing them for them all that time, and suddenly it's going to stop because they're going to move into the promised land. The generation who was with them are now gone. When Elizabeth died, many people said the death of our queen really breaks the link between the generation we have now and the generation that grew up in and went through the Second World War. And we can look back on the last 50 years of the 20th century and the first 20 years of this century. Elizabeth II was our queen for all that time. She was our link to that generation. She was always there, like Moses would always have been there. And now, she's not there anymore. And those who have been used to her being around, she was always there, you're just bereft. And this is the context in which Moses speaks, but it's also the context in which those in exile would have been looking at this to working out what this all meant. Moses' biggest concern is that the people of Israel remember who they are, where they came from, where they're going to. Unlike a lot of leaders who, when they step down, feel their work isn't quite finished and are very bitter about it. Leaders who essentially say in their goodbye speech, how could you possibly get rid of me when I haven't finished? Or leaders who say, I'm still supposed to be the leader and it's not fair. I'll be back. Moses is actually saying, hear now, O Israel, the decrees and laws I am about to teach you. Follow them so that you may live and may go and take possession of the land that the Lord, the God of your fathers, is giving you. Do not add to what I command you, and do not subtract from it, but keep the commands of the Lord your God that I give you. See, I have taught you decrees and laws that the Lord your God commanded me, so that you may follow them in the land you are entering to take possession of it. Observe them carefully, for this will show your wisdom and understanding to the nations, who will hear about all these decrees and say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. What other nation is so great? So that their God is near them, the way the Lord your God is near to us whenever we pray to him. And what other nation is so great as to have such righteous decrees and laws as this body of laws I am setting before you today? Now, I've actually jumped forward a bit. This is Deuteronomy chapter 4. In Deuteronomy chapters 1 to 3, Moses goes through the whole history. Egypt, Sinai, 40 years wandering around. How the people of Israel rebelled against God again and again. How they chickened out and wouldn't go into the promised land, even though Moses said, the Lord carried you through the desert as a father carries his son. And they wouldn't do it. And Moses knows these people are simply not going to be any different. So that's 1 to 3. In chapter 4, Moses begins to highlight how they need to behave because of this. His first thing is, you must not worship idols. You don't worship men, you don't worship women, you don't worship animals, you don't worship the moon, you don't worship the stars, you don't worship anything apart from the Lord your God. This, interestingly, is the argument that Jewish people will use about not worshipping Jesus, but we'll get to that later. The point is, no idol worship, and that is so different. We really need to understand now how different that would be. Every nation worshipped gods of things. There was a god for dust. There was a god for seeds. There was a god of the sun. There was a god of the stars. There was a god of the moon. There was a god of the wind. There was a god of the rain. There was a god of the harvest. There was probably even a god for using the toilet. But I've not heard who that god is, and I don't think I really want to find out. The point is, they were convinced everything had to be run by a god. And if the harvest didn't come, or the rain didn't come, it must mean the god was angry. And you had to pacify that god by making some kind of sacrifice. Everyone does that. Not you, says God. And Moses actually highlights this in the same chapter. Ask now about the former days, long before your time, from the day God created man on earth. Ask from one end of the heavens to the other, has anything so great as this ever happened? Or has anything like it ever been heard of? Has any other people heard the voice of God speaking out of the fire as you have and lived? Has any God ever tried to take for himself one nation out of another nation by testing, by miraculous signs, by wonders, by war, by a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, or by great and awesome deeds, like all the things the Lord your God did for you in Egypt before your very eyes? Well, has a God ever done that? Of course not. And that is why they need to follow these laws. From chapter 6 to chapter 10, we go on to hear about how they need to worship the Lord, how the worship will work, the sacrifices they make. But the key verse is actually Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 4 and 5. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength. This is the Shema. Shema Israel. Elohena Adonai, Adonai Ahad. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, Lord is one. Or to give it its actual translation, hear, O Israel, Yahweh our God, Yahweh one. The point of this is there is only one God. And that is so important to what we believe. It's the prayer every Jew who is religious will say every day, several times. Says that when he gets up, says it when he goes to bed, says it when he's in the synagogue. It's the prayer that Jesus prayed all the time. It's the prayer that everybody in the Old Testament who wrote a book or who appears as a faithful follower of God in the Bible would have prayed over and over again. It's the prayer that Paul prayed every day of his life. It's the prayer the disciples would have prayed every day of their lives, even after they met Jesus. Why? And also, you begin to see here in Deuteronomy some of the verses which appear in the Bible. Listen to this one. Fear the Lord your God, serve him only, and take no oaths in his name, and take your oaths in his name. Do not follow other gods, the gods of the peoples around you. For the Lord your God, who is among you, is a jealous God, and his anger will burn against you, and he will destroy you from the face of the land. Do not test the Lord your God, as you did at Massah. Jesus uses two of those verses when he's fighting against Satan in the wilderness. This is how important the book of Deuteronomy is. The people of Israel must remember who they are and who their God is. In the film The Lion King, there's a scene where the ghost of Mufasa, the slain king of the jungle, appears to his son and says, "You've forgotten me because you've forgotten yourself. Remember who you are." And essentially, this is what Moses is saying. You will forget if you forget God, and you will forget God if you forget who you are and what he's done for you. And that's why in the next few chapters, they're told that they must not break any of these rules. They must not make any covenant with the people they are going to be among. They must not allow any of their sacrifices to stand. Destroy all their idols, God said. Utterly devote them to the Lord. Now, I'm sure this will come up in question time, so let's just focus on this for a minute. It is very difficult for us to understand. Why would God say, kill all these people? Some people have tried to get round it by saying, oh, it's hyperbole. He didn't mean it. Some people have tried to get round it by saying, oh, this is the Old Testament and Jesus is the better covenant. This is actually wrong and Jesus had it right. Actually, the people of the land were pretty horrible people. If you read the books of Kings and the kind of practices Israel later adopt that was the things they did, it's just horrible. It's the stuff of nightmares. It really is. And God knew if they made contracts with these people, if they married them and started wandering off, they couldn't be a different people. They would become a similar people. And that's why in chapter 8, Moses is always saying, follow these laws, hear these laws. And when he says hear or listen, he doesn't mean listen to me. He means, hear me, follow me, obey me. So chapter 8, be careful to follow every command I am giving you today so that you may live and increase and may enter and possess the land the Lord your God promised on oath to your forefathers. Remember how the Lord your God led you through the way in the desert these 40 years to humble you and to test you in order to know what is in your heart, whether or not you would keep his commands. He humbled you, caused you to go hungry, and then fed you with manna that neither you nor your fathers had known, to teach you that man does not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of God. Your clothes did not wear out, and your feet did not swell during those 40 years. Now, you'll probably remember, if you've been listening, this is another phrase that Jesus used when Satan suggests he turns stone into bread. The context of that response is that God is everything to you, and they do not deserve this. They're not getting it because they're a bigger nation. They're not. They're not getting it because they're a righteous nation, because they most certainly are not. They're getting it because God loves them. So when someone says you have to follow the laws or God won't be so pleased with you, just remember what he's saying to Israel. You're a difficult, rebellious, stiff-necked lot. You're always breaking my rules, and you're going to break them again. But I promised I would bring you into this land, so I will. Not because of you, but because I made that promise, and I keep my promises. Here we begin to move on to the land which the people of Israel must live in. We don't really need to go into lots of details about that, because you can read it yourself in Deuteronomy. And in January, we're expecting to have Peter Guinness to come and take Leviticus apart for us. And Leviticus lays down virtually all of these laws in a slightly shorter format. But let's just highlight a few things. God is interested in everything which the people of Israel do. And that is not like any other god anyone's ever heard of. All the other gods don't really care how you behave, as long as you pay them homage, as long as you pay them respect. Pay us respect and you can do what you like. I don't really care if you're a liar and a cheat, as long as you don't make me annoyed. I don't care if you move your neighbor's boundary stone and pinch his field, but you must remember to sacrifice to me. I don't care if you murder someone by mistake or who punishes you for it. Just do as you're told and stop and don't bother me. I live in heaven, you live down here, and we don't have anything to do with each other. Just don't pee me off. That is the kind of attitude the nations had to their gods. So they didn't understand this God who had rules about how you kept your debts, who insisted that you must let all your people go free in the seventh year, who warned that he would be annoyed with anyone who was tight-fisted or stingy with borrowing or lending things, because in the next year it would all be cancelled. I don't want to catch you doing that, God says. If I do catch you doing it, I will not be pleased. A God who says there are cities to be built for people who accidentally commit murder. A God who says that if you go to war, you can go home if you've just got engaged. You can go home if you've just built a house. You can go home if you've just planted your vineyard. And even though, of course, it's completely different to now, you could already imagine a general going, I can't tell my men that. I'll have half of them sneaking off. He wants to govern every part of their lives and be involved with everything they do. He even says that when they tithe, they must take that to his resting place and have a meal and have fun and make sure you invite the stranger to come along with you. They're welcome. They can come and eat with you. If you want to kill a goat, but the place you're going to is too far away, you can have it at home. And the point he's making there is, when you kill a goat, normally, it's a sacrifice. You make it a sacrifice because essentially you're inviting the gods to come to your party. God's saying, if you just want to eat meat, it's not a sacrifice. So I don't want to see you sacrificing it on a high place. You want it to be a sacrifice, bring it to where I am. If you don't want it to be a sacrifice, then just eat it. Okay? Just eat it and enjoy yourself. All of these appear up to Deuteronomy chapter 20. I've selected a few things at random, but if you want to understand the whole list, go and have a look at Deuteronomy chapters 10 to chapter 27. I know that's an awful lot to go through, but that's essentially where all of these different rules are laid out. So that's a couple of things to notice. One last thing to notice, they're told to look after the poor and the needy and the stranger. Be kind to the alien and the stranger, God says. You were strangers and aliens once. So I would say people in this world now who don't like people coming into their country, who don't see why they should be kind to someone who doesn't belong to their group, really ought to look at that again. The people of Israel were commanded to be kind to the alien in their midst. They were commanded to be kind to the widow, essentially somebody who's got no husband to provide for her. They were commanded to be kind to the orphan, somebody who's got no family to support them. Essentially, be nice to the destitute people and the people who aren't part of your group and the people who you really don't want near you. That is not a if I want to, when I've got time, when I've got enough money. It's do it now, because that's how you were until I rescued you, God says. So you must do it. The tithe. Part of that is a sacrifice which you take to God's resting place. That would have been Jerusalem at the time people in the exile were reading this, or the time later people were reading this. And the other thing you were meant to do with it every 3 years was to set it aside, and on the third year, you gave it to the orphan, the widow, and the Levite. Interestingly enough, the Levites, God's priests, were also people who didn't have land of their own or an inheritance of their own, so they were dependent on the care of the people. God could have given the Levites the best of the land, but he doesn't. And very crucially, for the people who would have been reading this then, is in chapter 17, they are told, when you come into your land, you will say to yourselves, let's set a king over us so we can be like all the other nations. So although they weren't really supposed to have a king, God knew that was what they were going to do. There will be an argument that this would have been written after Moses, but that's not really important. The point actually is that their kings had certain standards. Their king couldn't be a foreigner. Their king couldn't have many horses, and he shouldn't buy them from Egypt. The king couldn't have many wives, in case he started thinking about them instead of about God. The king could not have lots and lots of gold, because then he'd get greedy. In fact, the king was not allowed to look down on any of his fellow Israelites. Instead, he was to have the law, keep it by him, and read it. And anyone reading that would have thought, oh dear, that didn't happen. And it didn't. The greatest king of Israel, King Solomon, who built the temple, had many wives, had many horses, had lots of gold, and it went to his head. I say that because, as we've said already, we need to be thinking about what the people reading this would have thought. I've already heard some conservative Christians complaining to me because I'm going for this idea that it was edited on the grounds that that's a very liberal view. But actually, it's not. It's a very sensible view. Because as Graham has said, the way it was written, the way it's been written, shows that people have tweaked it a bit. So we know that people would have been reading this during the exile or just before the exile. Okay, one more thing. No false prophets, no mediums, no soothsayers, no talking to the dead, and those very strange dietary laws. God is not the God of death. There will be false prophets. Moses says that you're not to follow them if what they say happens, if they then talk about other gods. If they claim to speak for God, but then what they say doesn't happen, you can't follow them either. You actually have a messianic verse here. Out of me will come a prophet, like me will come, a prophet will come out of you from your own people, and you must listen to them. In that context, he was saying there will be other prophets. But you can see how this talks about Jesus if you follow me to the end. So at the end of Deuteronomy chapter 28, Moses goes through everything again. They're to go to different mountains in Israel. They're to stand on these mountains and they're to pronounce blessings and cursings. The blessings will be what happens to you if you follow the law. The cursings will be what happens if you don't. And he has a very dire warning in chapter 28 too. If you follow me, God says, if you follow this law, everything will go right for you. You will be the head, not the tail. Your vines will prosper. Your wombs will prosper. Your livestock will prosper. Your harvest will be good. The rain will come. Some people have used this to try to go for prosperity gospel teaching. So I just want to explain what that would mean. At the time where Moses lived, the harvest was uncertain. It was dependent on the weather. Infant mortality rate was high. Livestock mortality rate was high. People died young, and a simple disease could kill you. So when it says your vines will flourish, your harvest will flourish, you won't have diseases, you'll be blessed in the town, you'll be blessed in the country, that's what he's talking about. For them, that would be a blessing. It does not follow that if you follow God, everything will come out right. Because just look at these laws. Can you imagine trying to follow those? It's extremely difficult. And if they ignore him, and this is important for what comes next, it'll all be the other way. You'll be cursed in the town. You'll be cursed in the country. You'll be cursed wherever you go. Your livestock won't prosper. Your children will die. You will marry someone and someone else will take her. You will build a house and someone else will live in it. You will plant a vineyard and someone will take it. If you follow God, when the enemy came at you from one direction, they fled in every direction. Now, your enemy will come at you in one direction and you will run in every single direction. And by the end of it, you'll be so destitute, you'll go back to Egypt asking to be slaves and nobody will buy you because you're in such an awful state. Interestingly, if you read through the prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Obadiah, Hosea, that's a great start, and all the other prophets who were talking about calamity falling on Israel, they will use the kind of language you find in Deuteronomy. Compare it sometime and look at the differences. And in chapter 29, it's time for Moses to sum up. And his key verse telling the people to obey the law is chapter 29, verse 29. The secret things belong to the Lord our God, but the things revealed belong to us and to our children forever, that we may follow all the words of this law. And in chapter 30, we get this promise, which we must always come back to when we just look at this and think, oh, this is just so disheartening. However bad it gets, God will always relent. He will always bring them back, even when they're a pretty ungrateful, undeserving lot. In chapter 30, you get a key line, which a Jewish person might say to you sometime, which argues the law can be kept. Moses says, now what I am commanding you today is not too difficult for you or beyond your reach. It is not up in heaven so that you may say, who will ascend into the heavens to get it and proclaim it to us so that we may obey it? Nor is it beyond the sea, so that you will have said, so you will have to ask, who will cross the sea to get it and proclaim it to us so that we may obey it? No, the word is near you. It is in your mouth and in your heart, so you may obey it. This day I call heaven and earth as witnesses against you that I have set before you life and death, blessings and cursings. Now choose life that you and your children may live. This has been written very much like a contract between a Syrian lord and his underlings. This is our covenant, this is our contract. Some have said this proves Moses didn't write it. Actually, I think it proves that Moses did make these speeches. Most of it would have been written down in case people forgot. And when it was put together, it's laid out like a contract between an Assyrian lord and his underlings, because that way they can understand exactly what they're looking at, a contract between them and God. Is it going to work? Are they going to follow Jesus? Are they going to follow God? They didn't even know who Jesus was then. Well, we're going to find out in chapter 31, because in chapter 31, Joshua is commissioned. It's time for the buck to be passed from Joshua to Moses. I've always felt rather sorry for Joshua when he's told that. I mean, imagine being told that you're going to be in Moses' place. You know everyone's going to be comparing him to you, even the people who didn't know him very well. A little bit like our poor King Charles will know that people will be comparing him to his mother, the Queen, from now on, and looking for anything that suggests he is not as good as her. Okay, this comparison's not wise, but you can see the point. But here, after Joshua is commissioned, he's told to be strong, he's told to be courageous, he's told God is going to go with him into the promised land. It looks like it will work. It looks like they finally got the message. And then God appears to Moses in the tabernacle, and it says, this is Deuteronomy chapter 31, and the Lord said to Moses, you were going to rest with your fathers, and these people will soon prostitute themselves to the foreign gods of the land they are entering. They will forsake me and break the covenant I made with them. On that day, I will become angry with them and forsake them. I will hide my face from them, and they will be destroyed. Many disasters and difficulties will come upon them. And on that day, they will ask, how have these disasters come upon us? Because have these disasters not come upon us because the Lord is not with us? And I will certainly hide my face on that day because of all their wickedness in turning to other gods. Now, what you're hoping is that he will go on and say, but I will rescue them, I will come to them, I will comfort them. But he doesn't. Instead, Moses is asked to sing a song in front of the people, which he does, and it's written down. In fact, the first four verses are what makes up a very old song I often heard sung in church. Ascribe greatness to our God the Rock, his name is perfect, and all his ways are just. A God of faithfulness and without injustice, good and upright is he. This is actually taken straight from the first few verses of Deuteronomy chapter 32. And if you want to know exactly what the original was, well, you'll have to read it. But it's an accusation that the people have broken God's laws. And in this accusation is a messianic verse. They made me jealous by what is no God and angered me because of their worthless idols. I will make them envious by those who were not a people. I will make them angry by a nation that has no understanding. Thousands of years later, Paul quotes these words in his heartbreak over the fact that the Jewish people have not followed God. But he does say, God's making them envious through Jesus so that they may return. essentially, if they've decided to follow worthless gods, God will annoy them and make them jealous by a group of people who to them have no right to have an understanding, but they still seem to have it. Let's remember that whenever we pray for the Jewish people we meet, that they may be made jealous by a nation that has no understanding, and angry by a nation that is not a nation. Yeah, I got that backwards, I know, never mind. And in the last chapter, Moses blesses the people of Israel in the same way that Jacob blesses his sons before he dies. You can read the exact wording and what each tribe will get and what each tribe will get up to in Deuteronomy chapter 33. And then Moses climbs a mountain. God shows him the land in all its splendor. Moses dies, and his body is never found. Because for Moses, it was always God. He understood the most important thing about being a leader. He wasn't a master. He wasn't a ruler. He was a servant. And that's why he gets this obituary. Since then, no prophet has risen in Israel like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face, who did all these miraculous signs and wonders the Lord sent him to do in Egypt, to Pharaoh and to all his officials and to his whole land. For no one has ever shown the mighty power or performed the awesome deeds that Moses did in the sight of all Israel. And there, the Torah ends. It's the end of the five books of teaching and Moses' story. And it's actually quite inconclusive. They're still going to break God's laws. However much they promise they won't, it looks like they always will. Moses thought they would. God knew they would. How on earth is this all going to play out? Well, Joshua, my friends, is now in charge of the nation, and Joshua is another story. So before we go to questions, what can we learn from Moses? Well, it's not very popular nowadays to look back on where we are and how we got there and do it properly. We do it for two reasons. One is to look back and say, in the good old days, our country was great. Let's make our country great again. And conveniently forgetting all the things we got wrong. Another way of doing it is to look back and say, weren't we stupid, unprogressive, dumb, uneducated, and didn't know anything in those days? Isn't it wonderful that we're better now? We're more progressive, we're more liberal, we're more understanding. Neither of those is a great idea. It's always going to miss things out. Deuteronomy has a good look at how the people of Israel got to where it's going. And very often in the church, we need to do that. We need to look back and ask ourselves, exactly how did we follow God? Exactly where did we sometimes get things wrong? Where did we sometimes get things right? And what do we do? The people of Israel were called to be different. And that is really unpopular at the moment. This is why people don't like the idea that Moses told the people of Israel to smash these other nations' idols, break down their altars, get rid of their sacred stones, get rid of all the high places. They cannot assimilate. They cannot try to have God and have the other gods as well. As we know, to their cost, that's exactly what they did do. And we are called to be different people. We cannot be the same people as the people around us on the grounds that way more people will think church looks cool and church looks trendy and that Christianity is a great thing. Whether it be in a group of conservatives or in a group of liberals, we are called to be a different people, a peculiar people in some versions. So that's not in Deuteronomy. And how do we use Deuteronomy? Well, I know some people would like to say, can't we just keep the first few chapters and the last few chapters? Can't we just go to the important bits and ignore the rest of it? That would be a lot easier, but we can't, because you can only understand those bits of Deuteronomy in the context of the rest of it. And there is also a glimmer of hope. Many years after Deuteronomy was written, a king called Josiah had a priest come to see him who had found a book of the law in the temple, probably a version of Deuteronomy. He read it and he tore his clothes and he wept when he saw how far behind Israel had got. So he went into the temple and prayed to God. And even though God said the nation had fallen too far for him to redeem it completely, Josiah was commended for being obedient. And after the exile, somehow the people seemed to learn their lesson. They did stop following foreign gods. In fact, at the time that Jesus came on the scene, for all their bumps, the Jewish people were a nation who understood, "Hear, O Israel, Yahweh our God, Yahweh one." That didn't mean that they hadn't found other ways of irritating him, of course, but they had got that message. And I don't believe that's because they somehow looked at Deuteronomy and said, "Oh, we've done this all wrong, let's do better." They got that message because the grace of God allowed them to finally get it right. And let's pray that now a prophet like Moses has risen from among his own people, they will come to understand their Messiah has truly come, and his name is Jesus, or Yeshua HaMashiach in Hebrew. Right, I will hand back to Graham with questions and comments.
Thank you, David. Do you want to have a little sip to begin with while I make some comments?
Thanks.
Yes, thank you, David. Thank you, David. That was a very comprehensive look at Deuteronomy. And what concerns me is that when we get a good coverage like that, that we then think, oh, I don't need to read Deuteronomy. David's told me all about it. No, we need to read it. Because it struck me towards the end there that just like it can be said that if you want to read one book of the New Testament to understand salvation, read Romans. If there's one book in the Old Testament you need to read to understand what the Old Testament is mostly about, it's Deuteronomy. It contains so much in there. There were a few points I thought was quite interesting that David obviously couldn't pick out because he would be here for a couple of hours. One thing that really struck me towards the beginning of Deuteronomy, for example, chapter 5, verse 23, it says, "When you heard the voice out of the darkness while the mountain was ablaze with fire, all the leading men of your tribes and your elders came to me." Chapter 7, verse 19. "You saw with your own eyes the great trials, the miraculous signs and wonders, the mighty hand and outstretched arm with which the Lord your God brought you out." But the people that Moses is talking to weren't. They didn't see these things with their own eyes, did they? This was a new generation. God is treating the people of Israel as one nation, not just the people of the time, but their forefathers. their antecedents. And I remember Michelle Guinness saying at one of our Passovers how one of her elder relations would describe how he suffered under the oppression of Egypt as a slave, because they took on board that this was the same for them. They were the same people. And that's an interesting concept, isn't it? Because nowadays in our individualistic attitude where it's nothing to do with me, that was my dad. It's nothing to do with me, that just because it was my son did it. No, it's all about, what do you call it? Joint responsibility, taking responsibility as a nation here. And I just thought that was very interesting, which we just read it and we think, oh yes, it's saying this, but actually you think, no, those people weren't there. They hadn't seen it. So I thought that was an interesting point. Another one that came to me was chapter 6:24. The Lord commanded us to obey all these decrees and to fear the Lord our God, so that we might always prosper and be kept alive, as is the case today. And if we are careful to obey all this law before the Lord our God, as he has commanded us, that will be our righteousness. Now, you can keep the law and be righteous according to that, can't you? But I think the wording is very interesting. That will be our righteousness, not that will make us righteous. So God has shown his grace by calling this people, rescuing them from Egypt, putting up with their disobedience. And Moses is saying, if they keep the law, it will be enough to be counted as righteousness. The law did not make them righteous. God would count it as righteousness. Only Jesus can make us righteous. But this is the clue that in the Old Testament there was a way, there was hope for salvation, but it was being counted as righteous. It didn't make them righteous. So keeping the law doesn't make you righteous. Even if God chooses by grace to make it count as righteousness, because Jesus came and gave the ultimate sacrifice. So I will finish there and ask for questions.